I have joining me on the phone Fawn Nguyen. He lives in Olympia, Washington. He is the coordinator for the ISM support group in Olympia. He knew Rachel Corrie, in fact, prepared her for her activism in the Gaza Strip before she left. And he does a show on Chaos in Olympia, Washington, Chaos Radio 89.3 FM from 4 to 6 on Sundays. So in a little less than an hour, his show will start. Fawn Nguyen recently sent out a press release regarding an article which is in the Mother Jones September-October 2003 issue entitled Death of an Activist, Was Rachel Corrie a Martyr or a Fool? By Joshua Hammer. And he states in this press release, Newsweek reporter commits plagiarism for Mother Jones. An article in the September-October 2003 issue of Mother Jones, ridiculing human rights activists, has been discovered to be marred by plagiarism and other objectionable practices. The article entitled The Death of Rachel Corrie was written by Newsweek's Jerusalem bureau chief Joshua Hammer. The article discusses the death of human rights activist Rachel Corrie and the activist group she was working with, the International Solidarity Movement. It has been discovered that Joshua Hammer had plagiarized an article by Sandra Jordan in the UK Observer. Additionally, Hammer sampled false information from David Horowitz's ultra-right-wing website, Front Page Magazine, again without citing his source. The consequence is that the article is riddled with errors, half-truths, and dubious sources of information. Although this matter has been brought to the attention of the staff of Mother Jones, they have not yet provided a response. To view the details of Hammer's plagiarism, you can visit either counterpunch.org or electronicintifada.net, and there's also a link to the original article from both of those websites. We're going to be talking about the plagiarism that took place in this article today with Fawn. Thank you for joining me this afternoon, Fawn.
Thanks for having me here.
Let's talk about your article, which I mentioned people can read at counterpunch.org or electronicintifada.net. It's titled Speculative Journalism, The Making of, quote, The Death of Rachel Corrie, which was the article written by Joshua Hammer. Why don't we begin by talking just a little bit about what drove you to research this article in the first place?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of, articles written about Rachel Corrie after she was killed, and some of them are, slightly inaccurate. Some are, very, very biased, and I've read so much trash being written about her, and I knew her personally, so I could tell, when they just made stuff up about her. And in this particular case, this article attracted a lot of attention, especially here in Olympia, because it does talk about Olympia as well, not just about her, but the kind of Olympia community. And a lot of people in Olympia were actually very, very upset by the article. People, not only people who knew her, but also people who live in Olympia and know what Olympia is about. And to read what this person who has never been to Olympia wrote, they were really surprised. And for a while, I actually was reluctant to read it because I saw the magazine and flipped to the first page, and what it said was it started out saying, martyr, idiot, dedicated, deluded. Why did this American college student crushed by an Israeli bulldozer put her life on the line, and did it matter, in big words on the first page? And so I was afraid it was just all sensationalist. I didn't want to deal with it. But eventually I did read it, and before I even finished reading it, I already realized that he had plagiarized some information, and as well there were a lot of dubious information that he had written in the article. And so I just started looking into where he got his sources, because he doesn't always cite where he got his sources, and that's when I discovered all this information about how he relied a lot on web surfing to find his information, and web surfing dubious websites such as Front Page Magazine, which is an ultra-right-wing website headed by David Horowitz.
Let's get into the details of that plagiarism in just a moment and how you uncovered it. But first, just do you know anything about the background of this man? You mentioned that he is the Jerusalem bureau chief for Newsweek. Is there anything else you can tell us about Joshua Hammer?
Yeah, I believe he's currently on a book tour, and he had just published a book entitled A Season in Bethlehem, which details primarily the events around Operation Defensive Shield in Bethlehem last spring. spring of last year, which was when the Church of the Nativity was under siege. Now, Joshua Hammer was there when all of that was happening. He was staying at the Bethlehem Star Hotel, and I was actually there at the same time, too, although I wasn't staying in the hotel. So we never actually met each other at the time. But yeah, he is Newsweek's Jerusalem bureau chief, and he was approached by Mother Jones to write this, to investigate Rachel Corrie's death, and I guess his mission was to kind of uncover like the last days of Rachel Corrie or something sensationalist like that, and this is what he turned up with.
I kind of wonder why Mother Jones would turn to someone from Newsweek to produce an article, considering that they are supposedly kind of out of the mainstream, left-wing magazine. You would think they would turn to somebody a little less mainstream or conservative, it seems.
Yeah, totally. And I was wondering that myself, too, why they decided to come to Joshua Hammer, and I don't know why they made that decision, but that's what they did, and they printed his article.
Let's talk about the article and what you uncovered. You state that fact-checking and verification was not a priority in the production of the article, and you start by giving the example of Hammer's description of a memorial service which was held for Corrie in Rafah soon after she was killed. Can you describe how his description was plagiarized and inaccurate?
Well, what I found first was one paragraph that he had written talking about how the memorial service was sponsored by Fatah and attended by representatives of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, and so on. And that phrase sounded very familiar. And so I looked it up on the web because I believed I had read that before. And sure enough, I found that that piece was taken from an article in the UK Observer not long after Rachel was killed. Now, what Joshua Hammer did was he took three paragraphs from this article in the UK Observer and kind of moved around the sentences so that it wasn't in the same order and changed a few phrases, but left a lot of it intact. And that came up, and that's how he provided his own version of the event. And of course, because he had moved things around, he got the story wrong. Sandra Jordan was actually writing about two different memorial services. He combined them into one while he was ripping off her article. Now, Joshua Hammer has actually responded to this, as well as the editor of Mother Jones, Roy Cohn. And what they said, their justification was that it was an accident, and he had actually provided the original Observer article in his fact-check file, which Mother Jones uses to check his sources, and they both seem to have overlooked this plagiarism. But what's interesting is that, so what he's saying pretty much is that he meant to paraphrase it even more, and so that it wouldn't be a flat-out plagiarism, but that he had accidentally left it as is. What's interesting about that is that in the process, he got the facts wrong, and not only that, but that he was actually intending on just copying and pasting and then modifying it enough so that it would be his own writing. So I don't see that as a real kind of a excuse for what he did.
He did not quote the Observer. He took three paragraphs from an article written by Sandra Jordan, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Reformulated them slightly, and then didn't even cite the Observer as his source, and in the process, it was a flaw because he presented it as one memorial service when in fact it was two separate memorial services.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this a problem for you? I mean, I understand the plagiarism, the fact that he didn't quote the Observer as his source and doesn't give us the opportunity to know that it wasn't his own words, but what else about that bothers you?
It's indicative of the rest of the story that he wrote, which is that he copied and pasted and did a lot of web surfing, and that's where he got his information, and then ended up sounding like he was an authority on these events that he had never even witnessed. And so, to me, that's sloppy journalism, which is actually representative of the rest of the article. And in fact, Mother Jones was informed about this. I informed them about it just before their next issue went to press. And I haven't seen the next issue, but I've been told by them that it contains a correction, and they correct the fact that that these were two separate memorial services, although they don't reveal why they got it wrong, which is namely that he plagiarized and then moved the pieces around. So they're willing to confess to the fact that these were actually two memorial services and not one, as Joshua Hammer had initially described, but they refuse to, they have so far not publicly admitted that this is plagiarism, or that he had stolen this from the UK Observer, although they do admit it privately.
That was only one complaint about the article that you had that you pointed out to Mother Jones, though. Are they going to correct, for example, the false statement in his article that the ISM, quote, upholds the right of Palestinians to carry out, quote, armed struggle, and seeks to, quote, establish divestment campaigns in the U.S. and Europe to put economic pressure on Israel, etc.? Is that statement going to be corrected, along with the claim that he makes in this article that the ISM supports suicide bombings? Are those false statements going to be corrected?
So far, Mother Jones has made no expression of an intent to correct those. As a matter of fact, Joshua Hammer has proceeded, even after this article, he has gone on to describe even more what he thinks ISM is all about. And September 24th, he gave an interview with WBEZ in Chicago while he was promoting his new book. And there they brought up the question about ISM because in response to his Mother Jones article, and they asked him what he thought about ISM. And in his words, and I'm going to quote directly, he said that there's a real tendency, I think, to romanticize Arafat. And he also says that that ISM glorifies the Palestinian cause and has a policy of showing up at the funerals of suicide bombers, which is totally ridiculous. I don't know where he got this information. He might have made it up, or he might have like kind of distorted it, but there is no ISM policy of attending funerals of suicide bombers. And in fact, the interviewer had asked him, did he think that, you know, this was maybe out of curiosity that these people had showed up, or was it a policy? And he explicitly said that he thought it was a policy. And
now,
so instead of correcting it, he's actually gone further.
What is Joshua Hammer's experience with the International Solidarity Movement that he knows so much about it? Did he go to their website and investigate what their statements are, what the group's statements are? Did he interview ISM people directly? Did he mingle with the ISM? Did he work for the ISM? What is his experience? Where does he get his information regarding the ISM?
Well, the segment that you quoted, interestingly enough, is actually part of where he got his information about ISM, which the little section you quoted comes from an article in Front Page Magazine, David Horowitz's right-wing website, which it was an article entitled Terrorist Martyr American Style, talking about Rachel Corrie specifically, but also like saying a lot of libelous things about her and ISM, which were never true. And the article the author of that article had kind of quoted ISM's mission statement out of context, and Joshua Hammer then quoted, without attributing, the Front Page Magazine article, which had distorted the quotation from the ISM website. And so Joshua Hammer quoted this thing about ISM coordinating divestment campaigns, which it doesn't, you know. Individual members might be involved in divestment campaigns, but that doesn't mean ISM does divestment campaigns, which it hasn't so far. And but he saw that as somehow important enough to quote in his article, this thing about divestment, and also this thing about armed struggle, which he leaves unclear what it means, armed struggle. And if you look at the ISM website, you'll see that ISM does support armed struggle in accordance with international laws. That is, that they acknowledge the Palestinian right to resist by all means that are accorded to them under international law, and ISM does not acknowledge violence that isn't in accordance with international law. And now, he left that out, and in fact, when I brought that up to him, he denied that that was part of ISM's mission.
No, but it's quite clear if you go to their website and read their mission statement, which is very easy to do at palsolidarity.org. Not only do they state in their mission statement, they do refer to the right of Palestinian armed struggle, but only in the context of international law, of what is allowed under international law, which is an occupied people's right to resist. but not attacks on civilians. In fact, when I was looking at their website, I found a quite strong statement condemning suicide bombings. So I know just from, you know, it's just amazing to me that this man, Joshua Hammer, couldn't have presented a more balanced view when there is so much information out there. It seems to me he took a real right-wing stance. For him to cite this article on David Horowitz's website, Front Page Magazine, and yet not have cite a similar article from a left-wing source, or even from the website itself, where ISM's 900-word mission statement is readily available to anybody, it seems like a major distortion to me.
Yeah, exactly. And again, he didn't attribute where he got his source, which was not the ISM website, but from Front Page Magazine. And when I brought that up with him, he said, well, those quotes are in the mission statement, are they not? And of course they are, but not in that order and not in that context. And so he took a quote that was out of context and then tried to justify it by saying, well, the words are in there. But, you know, any professional journalist would know better than to just quote something out of context from a right-wing website to describe something that the right-wing website opposes. Or at the very least, he should have cited his source, which he didn't, and instead tried to justify it.
So the statement that he ended up printing was a plagiarized, distorted, out-of-context quote from a right-wing website. Now, can you talk about some of the other things that you found plagiarized in the article or that were not correct?
Okay, one thing that I didn't mention in my response, which I had found out after I had written my response, was that he even starts off his article with a fabrication. The article begins with a phone call that was made to Rachel Corrie the day that she was killed. And it was from a fellow ISM colleague, and who supposedly called her and said, and told Rachel, "The Israelis are back. Get over here right away. I think they're heading for Dr. Samir's house." And he puts it in quotes as if he was actually there when this phone call was made. Now, it turns out that this phone call was never made. It was actually one ISM member, Alice, who had called a different ISM member, Greg, and Greg happened to be with Rachel at the time. And he then relayed that message to Rachel. So this phone call between Alice and Rachel had never happened. And somehow he put this conversation in quotes as if he knew what was going on. And that's indicative of the artistic license that he had applied to this article, which is all over the place in this article. It's a lot of over-dramatizing the events. And so this whole story of a phone call never happened, and he had never interviewed Alice or Greg. So he didn't interview either of the people who were involved in the phone conversation, and yet he somehow started the article with this fabricated quote.
And, now, let's get back to his plagiarism of the right-wing articles from the Front Page Magazine website, David Horowitz's website. You mention, I'll quote here, "Of all the right-wing articles Hammer could choose to swipe from, he chose to swipe from Cantor's article, which is full of false statements, such as the libelous allegation that ISM activist Susan Barclay was working for Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Cantor even falsely attributes a quote to Rachel Corrie, quote, 'More martyrs are ready to defend the honor of Palestine,' unquote. None of this seems to trouble Hammer, who still finds Cantor credible enough to sample." Was Cantor's article the only one he cited from that right-wing website?
From the right-wing website, that was the most explicit one. He might have taken information from other parts of Front Page Magazine, although I'm not sure, because some of it has been, some of the kind of lies that have come out in regards to Rachel and ISM have been kind of forwarded and reprinted in several other websites, but a lot of them show up in Front Page Magazine. In this particular case, they had accused Susan Barclay of hiding a supposed Islamic Jihad member, Shadi Sakia, in Jenin. And what's interesting about that was that she was not anywhere near Jenin. She was actually in the United States during the IDF's apprehension of Shadi Sakia. And, of course, this has been reprinted everywhere, including Front Page Magazine and a lot of right-wing websites, such as the Jewish Telegraph Agency and Arutz Sheva, like the Settler news sources and stuff like that. So this is where he's getting his information, and somehow it doesn't seem to bother him that this article is full of holes such as that.
Let's talk about some of the comments he made in the article regarding that. He actually states that ISM, quote, I'll quote from the article here, ISM has also found itself placed on the defensive by its own recklessness. He goes on to describe that March 27th raid on the Janine office that you are talking about. Well, he calls it a raid in his article. And he also claims that the Red Cross pulled out, he claims that following the incident, the International Committee for the Red Cross, which occupies the same office in the compound, asked the ISM to leave. Let's talk about his claim that the ISM is reckless. First of all, addressing what you just spoke about, then the claim about the Red Cross asking him to leave, and then finally his making the connection between the ISM and the two Britons who blew themselves up in Tel Aviv at Mike's place. He claims that these were all reckless acts that the ISM was somehow involved in. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, what's interesting about that is that he uses the term reckless, but does not explain exactly how they are reckless, and also does not show that, you know, ISM was somehow directly involved in any way, or even like peripherally involved with any of these acts. For example, the Mike's Place bombing, he says that the two people who were with the Mike's Place bombing were posed as peace activists. And, you know, that had been distributed around the news a lot, that these people were posed as peace activists, but he doesn't explain how. And when I confronted him with this, he admitted that, well, he got it wrong, that they weren't really, they didn't pose as peace activists. There is no proof that they ever posed as peace activists. The most that ever happened was they said that they were there as alternative tourists. And there was, ISM did make do a press release and had a press briefing concerning the Mike's Place bombings, because these two British citizens had visited Rafa and actually met with some ISM people, but they were in a crowd of 15 people. So there were two people in a crowd of 15. They spoke a little bit and then went along their way. And somehow this was reckless because ISM allowed, you know, a couple of strangers among 15 people to be there, right, to be at the to visit ISM. Well, ISM is open and anyone can visit them, and that doesn't mean that ISM trained these people or anything like that. There's been allegations that they were trained by ISM or ISM helped smuggle them into Israel, and all of that is false. And Joshua Hammer doesn't say those things, but he still says that somehow it's reckless, and he doesn't explain how.
And you point out that it's completely false that the Red Cross asked the ISM to leave the premises. You point mm-hmm. that out in the article as well.
Yeah, this occurred in the Janine incident, in which Shadi Sukiya was pretty much, it was a young Palestinian man. There was a Israeli IDF kind of raid or roundup that they were going house to house, and it was raining pretty hard outside. And the ISM office was in a building that also houses the Red Cross, the ICRC office. And some ISM people had found this young man shivering and kind of all wet, and they took him in, and you know, just because he was seemed frightened and cold. And eventually the IDF entered this building and found Shadi Sukiya inside the ISM office. Now, they did not arrest anyone, any ISM person, in connection with Shadi Sukiya, despite news reports to the contrary. Some news reports have seemed to allege that, but they did not arrest anyone in connection with this, especially not Susan Barclay, who was in the United States at the time. But somehow this is reckless, because somehow perhaps ISM must have known that this guy was involved with Islamic Jihad, which isn't even clear, because he was subsequently put under administrative detention. Even though the IDF claims that he was some kind of senior Islamic Jihad militant who was responsible for all these suicide bombings, they did not press charges against him. Joshua Hammer has somehow brought this up and claimed that this is reckless of ISM to allow a shivering young man to go inside their office and to keep warm.
Here's a quote in your article. You quote the press release that the ISM issued after Sukiya was captured or taken from their office, they stated, "One of the volunteers went into the hallway to see what was happening and met a young man coming up the stairs. He looked terrified, was soaking wet, and appeared to be in pain. Concerned about his welfare, under Israeli military curfew, Palestinians spotted in the street or shot on sight. He was brought into the apartment. He spoke only Arabic, which none of the ISM volunteers present understood. He was given a change of clothes, a hot drink, and a blanket. Eventually, the military knocked on the ISM door, and 30 soldiers entered with their machine guns trained. They arrested the young man, claimed he was wanted. The two women were not able to prevent the soldiers from taking the young man, whose name they did not even know, but requested that he be treated humanely." And then you follow up by pointing out that later on, and this is not revealed, as you said, by Joshua Hammer in his article, that Sukiya was subsequently held under administrative detention. That is, he was held indefinitely without charges. No one in ISM has been charged. There was an additional claim that Hammer does not mention, that you point out he also does not mention, that the IDF claimed they found a pistol or two rifles in the ISM Jenin office when they apprehended Sukiya, which turned out to be false. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this happened immediately after the IDF had apprehended Sukiya. They claimed that, one IDF spokesperson claimed that a pistol was found. Another IDF spokesperson said it was two Kalashnikov rifles. And somehow this got out on the news. AP had printed something about it, but then they were forced to retract it after the IDF was confronted with their contradictions. And then they said, well, no guns were found in the ISM office. They thought they found a gun in the building or something like that. But it was too late. Front Page Magazine, one of Hammer's sources, actually makes this claim, but expands it to say that it was a weapons cache that was hidden inside the ISM office. And so you look on the web, you'll find a lot of references in right-wing websites to a weapons cache that was stored by ISM in their office, which is totally false. The IDF spokespeople have retracted that. AP has retracted that statement as well. And so again, you know, there was a lot of misinformation. Hammer doesn't quote any of that. He just attempts to show that ISM was reckless for housing this terrified young man that they didn't know.
Now, you also point out that he, when he does cite his source, that when he does mention his source, that he is still misleading. For example, can you talk about the quote that he, actually, he doesn't state the name of this right-wing columnist, but he says in his article that, and he's speaking about Evergreen State College, which is where Rachel Corrie attended Evergreen State College. What he has to say, Joshua Hammer, the author of this article, is that, first of all, he says this: "A distrust of authority and a passion for unpopular causes permeate the politics of both students and faculty. In 1999, Mumia Abu-Jamal, a former journalist and Black Panther convicted of first-degree murder in the shooting of a Philadelphia police officer, delivered Evergreen's commencement address via audio tape from death row, sparking outrage in conservative circles." I'd just like to comment that that paragraph is one I highlighted when I read the article, because he does not mention that Mumia Abu-Jamal has international support for a new trial, including Amnesty International has called for a new trial in his case. Leaders in the EU and around the world have supported Mumia, but he paints him as this just a convicted murderer, not someone who is... the world over, people are calling for justice in his case because they believe him to be innocent for good reason.
Mm-hmm.
So that leaves a certain image in your mind, if you don't know anything about Mumia's case, certainly that the students and faculty of this college are fools.
Yeah.
Then he goes on to quote, and he says, one columnist, he quotes, saying, quote, "The radical ideologies espoused every day at Evergreen State College are of every nasty branch of extremism, anti-Americanism, anti-God, anti-life, anti-Israel, anti-capitalism, anti-tradition." He doesn't say who it was who said this. Can you talk about who it was he actually quoted there?
Yeah, he quoted this person as a columnist, and it turns out that this columnist is an 18-year-old who has never attended the Evergreen State College. His name is Hans Zeiger. Totally ultra-conservative, just very, very, knows very little about Evergreen, and in fact, the article that Hammer quotes this from is an article about Rachel Corrie, and that's where Hammer found it. He surfed the web and looked up Rachel Corrie, perhaps on Google or something, and came up with this otherwise insignificant article entitled Mourning Rachel Corrie, A Tragedy of the Radical Left by Hans Zeiger. And so Hans Zeiger has never attended the Evergreen State College. He's been there a couple of times and talks about how sick Evergreen is because it celebrates, in his mind, homosexuality or whatever. And so he has developed this idea of the college based on his own homophobia. And
he also was only in the seventh grade. One of those visits, you mentioned he was in seventh grade.
That's correct. He only cites two visits to Evergreen, one that he made in the seventh grade. And somehow Hammer found this person to be a reliable authority. Now, again, I confronted Hammer with this. He said that, it's representative of what conservatives feel about Evergreen, which I don't find that to be correct. If he wanted to have a more representative statement from a more kind of, mainstream conservative, he could have quoted someone else, but he decided to quote find the most sensationalist quote he could find, and therefore he came up with anti-Americanism, anti-God, anti-life, anti-Israel, and that is not representative of the general conservative attitude towards Evergreen, even though, a lot of conservatives are opposed to Evergreen. They don't say these things that Evergreen is anti-Israel.
Well, he also didn't point out some of the other claims that Zeiger makes about Evergreen, as you say in your article. You say, interestingly, Hammer does not bother to quote Zeiger's homophobic statement in the same article, nor does Hammer note Zeiger's suggestion that Evergreen may have connections to, quote, terrorist organizations, or his ridiculous claim that Corrie, quote, had stood guard outside of Yasser Arafat's compound, unquote, when in fact she had never even set foot in Ramallah. Hammer conveniently ignores all these revelatory tidbits because that would destroy the credibility of the man whom Hammer selectively quotes and refers to simply as a, quote, columnist. Very misleading.
Yeah, and it was very misleading, and he admitted that when I confronted with him. I asked him, don't you think it's misleading for you to have just called him a columnist? You should have said who you quoted from, and he did admit to that.
Now, let's move on to another point you make in your article. You talk about the fact that Hammer, he insinuates, if not flat out accuses in his article, a witness, an eyewitness to Corey's killing. He calls him Joe Smith, or maybe Joe is calling himself Joe Smith, as he wants to remain somewhat anonymous. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that was how it was at the case.
Okay.
He has since gone public with his full name now that he's back in the United States.
I see. I get it.
Yeah.
So, anyway, he quotes Joe, and he basically gives the impression that he contradicts himself. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's very interesting. He found a contradiction in Joe's statement that, that the bulldozer saw Rachel as he was approaching her, but that later on, in a different interview, Joe had, quote, acknowledged that the bulldozer operator could well have lost sight of Corrie after she tumbled down the dirt pile. And somehow that's a contradiction, that when you're heading towards someone, you can see them, but when you're driving over them, you lose sight of them, and somehow that's two different, it's a chronological statement, and somehow he found that as contradictory because he took the two chronological statements and put it together and make it seem like it happened all at the same time. As a matter of fact, Joe, I did find an interview with Joe, interestingly enough, as interviewed by Sandra Jordan, who Joshua Hammer had originally plagiarized from. And in that interview, Joe actually does put it all in chronological order and does make it clear that it's no contradiction. And Hammer could have seen that interview if he had actually consulted with Sandra Jordan originally, but he didn't, and instead he tried to turn it into a contradiction, which it isn't. And interestingly enough, he quotes the IDF spokesperson, Sharon Feingold, quite comprehensively, but does not find any contradiction in any of her statements.
The IDF spokesperson.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, for the Israeli army.
Mm-hmm.
He does. He quotes her throughout the article, but never once in any way tries to present an opposing view. On the other hand, he makes makes statements about the ISM, or he'll quote someone from the ISM, but then he always follows it up with a comment from the IDF, it seems like. For example, he talks about how after Rachel Corrie's killing, Israeli troops shot three more foreign civilians working in the West Bank and Gaza, and he describes Tom Herndahl, Brian Avery, and James Miller's shootings by the Israeli army. After he's finished, he concludes the paragraph by saying, quote, "We do not target civilians," IDF spokeswoman Feingold assured me. In the case of Herndahl, she said, a gunman was coming out of a house and started shooting, and a single shot was fired toward this gunman. Herndahl was hit. Miller, she explained, was outside filming in pitch-black darkness just as someone fired an anti-tank rocket from somewhere nearby, and the soldiers returned fire. This is what he concludes his paragraph about Brian Avery, Tom Herndahl, and James Miller's killings with, but he doesn't bother to mention the opposing views, which are those of the eyewitnesses who said there was no such Palestinian gunfire around Tom Herndahl or around James Miller, and certainly not in the case of Brian Avery. So what I'm saying is that he'll present, he tries to make the article look as though it's balanced by saying something about the ISM that seems somewhat fair, but then he'll always end the statement with something from the IDF that he does not challenge with eyewitness testimony.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, if you look at how he quotes these people, he says that ISM activists claim such and such, while when he quotes Sharon Feingold, the IDF spokesperson, he quotes her as having assured or explained to him the facts. And you know, so that's somewhat biased there. Now, he does, you know, and it's okay to question ISM. Like, if ISM makes a statement, sure, you should question it and find, and if it, you find some kind of real contradiction, you should bring that up. If you find, like, testimony that that says otherwise, you should bring that up. But he doesn't do that with the Israeli military. And so when Sharon Feingold makes these assertions, now, it's so easy for Joshua Hammer to have just, asked. There were, I believe, maybe 13 eyewitnesses to Tom Herndahl's shooting. He didn't bring any of that up. And there's actually video footage of James Miller's death. He didn't bring that up. And the fact that, you know, the eyewitnesses to James Miller's death were, you know, reporters just like him. So they might have been more reliable sources. But he did not bring any of that up. And nor did he bring up the fact that the accusations about James Miller, of how he was killed, has evolved over time. The Israeli military has changed their story as new evidence comes up, and they keep trying to, like, contradict the new evidence by changing their story, and he doesn't bring any of that up.
And to return briefly to the statement he makes about Joe Smith, what he says as he describes, I'll just briefly quote from Joshua Hammer's article, he says, was it murder? Corrie's colleagues believe that it was. Quote, I never dreamed it'd be like this, the intentional crushing of a human being, ISM eyewitness Joe Smith wrote in an affidavit filed with Palestinian human rights attorneys. I do believe it was intentional. I saw it, and I know he saw her. I know he did. And I know he knew she was still under the bulldozer when it backed up without raising its blade. I don't know if he wanted to kill her, or if he was just focused on doing his work and didn't care if he killed her or not. I don't know which is scarier, unquote. Five other activists testified that the driver must have seen Corrie before mowing her down. A damning sequence of photographs shot by ISM activists and almost immediately released by Reuters appears to show Corrie standing before the bulldozer and addressing the soldiers with her megaphone seconds before she was being crushed. In the second paragraph, he says, yet Smith later gave an interview in which he acknowledged that the bulldozer operator could well have lost sight of Corrie after she tumbled down the dirt pile. So he's claiming this is a contradiction. You're saying this is not a contradiction because Joe Smith actually says in chronological order in Sandra Jordan's interview with him, what?
He pretty much said everything that Joshua Hammer has quoted, but in chronological order. Here, Joshua Hammer doesn't quote it all in chronological order and instead makes it sound like Joe Smith's statements were concerning the exact same times, that somehow the driver saw her and didn't see her at the same time, and that's somehow the contradiction. When in the interview with Sandra Jordan, Joe Smith, and this was an interview that took place just a few days after Rachel was killed, he actually makes it clear the chronology of it all taking place. And it starts out with the soldiers seeing clearly Rachel, when the bulldozer kept approaching Rachel and started pushing a dirt pile towards her, she climbed on top of the dirt pile enough so that she could see eye-to-eye level the bulldozer operators. And that was when she started getting sucked in and fell into the dirt pile. And at that point, of course, the soldiers would not have seen her as they drove over her. And so that's not really a contradiction. And as a matter of fact, what's another interesting thing is Joshua Hammer never actually quotes the official Israeli conclusion to their investigation, their so-called investigation into Rachel's death. And so he never describes how the Israeli military claims that Rachel was never even run over by a bulldozer, that she was probably killed by a falling slab of concrete, which of course contradicts the Israeli conducted autopsy report. And you would think that this would be something that's worth talking about in his article, except he never mentions the actual investigation results.
He also doesn't mention the fact that those eyewitnesses, and I believe there was 8 of them to Rachel's killing, rushed forward as the bulldozer was running over her, basically screaming at him to stop.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. It wasn't just like, even if the bulldozer driver hadn't seen Rachel, which all the eyewitnesses said he did, mm-hmm. all the ones who saw the whole progression. Now, he certainly saw these people running forward from all sides, shouting at him to stop. I mean, Joshua Hammer doesn't even point that out.
Yeah, instead...
It's almost like he's attempting to discredit eyewitnesses through his misleading writing.
Yeah, he didn't really interview all the eyewitnesses. And there were a few eyewitnesses that he did interview, except that he seems to have gotten the information wrong or didn't quote them in the entirety. In fact, you know, I don't know how many eyewitnesses he had quoted in the article. I believe Joe Smith might have been the only eyewitness he quoted, and he didn't even quote him directly. He quoted from other interviews that he didn't conduct.
You know what, you're absolutely right. I'm looking at the article, and Joe Smith is the only eyewitness that he quotes, even though there was 8.
Mm-hmm.
He only quotes 1, and when he does, that's exactly what I just read. He tries to make it look as if the man contradicted himself, when in fact he didn't.
Yeah.
Now, he also actually quotes the driver of the bulldozer, who he says, he quotes him from a TV, I believe he was on Israeli TV, he says, and what the man said was, "You can't hear well, you can't see well, you can go over something and you'll never know it. I scooped up some earth, I couldn't see anything, I pushed the earth, I didn't see her at all, maybe she was hiding in there." He quotes the driver. He also goes on to claim that He goes on to say that the IDF compiled a video about the incident, which he claims makes a credible case that the operator may not have seen her. Now, you mentioned that in your article, this footage that mm-hmm. he talks about.
Yeah, I've seen the footage myself, too. It was aired on Israeli Channel 2, I believe, and I believe that's where he got that video footage, too. And, yes, it does show the inside of a bulldozer, of a bulldozer, not the drivers or anything, just the inside of a bulldozer, just to demonstrate that it's hard to see. But, of course, you can see what's in front of you, or you would expect that a bulldozer operator should be able to see what's in front of them when they're driving one. And they had, you know, and they had been dealing with the ISM activists for hours. They knew the activists were there. They could have stopped their operation at any time, but they proceeded to work regardless of the human beings who were right in front of them. And, you know, they knew they were there because they had fired warning shots, lobbed tear gas grenades, or whatever. And so these people weren't just operating blindly.
In fact, Rachel Corey had spoken with that very bulldozer driver 10 minutes before he ran her over.
Yeah, they had talked with the bulldozer driver, and if you read any of the statements from the eyewitnesses, they do say that, you know, at some points the bulldozer driver, even like one of the operators, even posed for the camera too, and so they were well aware that these operators were well aware that the activists were there. And as a matter of fact, after that one bulldozer ran over Rachel, Joe Smith, his real name is Joe Carr, by the way, you know, it's public now, his name is Joe Carr,
mm-hmm.
and he actually ran after the bulldozer that killed Rachel, and tried to take a picture of its license number, and a picture of the man's face, one of the operators who was in the bulldozer, and the bulldozer started weaving away because it knew what he was up to, so it was actually running away from him, after he killed Rachel.
And my understanding is that what happened after he killed Rachel is that he and the other bulldozer operator that was working in the area drove quite a distance away, parked, and just kind of hung out. They didn't make
That's
any
correct.
Effort. They had showed no remorse. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, I've hit someone. We need medical help. They made no effort to get medical help. The activists who were witnesses to her killing had to get it. They had to get the Red Crescent Society ambulance. And my understanding is that the soldiers involved in this showed no remorse whatsoever or even an attempt to help. And, in fact, you mentioned that you mentioned this just a moment ago, actually, but I'll just repeat it, that when he talks about having seen this Israeli propaganda video, he doesn't go on to mention that the official Israeli investigation basically doesn't even mention that the bulldozer drove over Rachel Corrie.
That's correct. That's actually what the investigation concluded, that she was killed by a falling slab of concrete and at no time did the bulldozer drive over Rachel, which totally contradicts the photo that's even printed in Mother Jones magazine, which shows the tread marks. Now the treads never ran over Rachel, but the shovel did, because the shovel was in a down position when it ran her over and backed up. But you can see the tread marks that are around her in the photo that's provided by Mother Jones magazine. Now, Joshua Hammer could have looked at that and said, wait a minute, there's something fishy about IDF claims that the bulldozer never ran her over. Instead, he never even quotes the IDF, which, you know, for instance, The Guardian does. The Guardian is where he got Sandra Jordan's article. The Observer, which mm-hmm. is part of The Guardian, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Fawn Nguyen from his home in Olympia, Washington. I just have a couple more questions for you. I know you have to start your show very soon at 4 o'clock. Fawn lives in Olympia. He knew Rachel Corrie. He's a coordinator for the International Solidarity Movement in Olympia. And you can read his article at counterpunch.org or electronicintifada.net. And what his article is research into an article written by Joshua Hammer called Death of an Activist, Was Rachel Corrie a Martyr or a Fool? In the September-October 2003 issue. I'm not going to cover everything that you went over in your article because people can go and read it themselves. It's called Speculative Journalism, The Making of the Death of Rachel Corrie, by Fawn Nguyen. You can read it again at counterpunch.org or electronicintifada.net. Why don't we just now, since you only have a few minutes before you have to start your own radio show, just if there's anything, there was so much more to your article, maybe you can just cite a couple more things that you found extremely important, because we're not going to be able to cover everything.
Well, let's see, I don't know where to... Yeah, a lot of the information is just right there. I've stated it in my article, but I can tell you about, you know, what Mother Jones's response has been. Pretty much their response has been to issue a correction, that tiny correction that I had mentioned earlier about the two memorial services that were combined into one, failing to mention that the reason why it was written in error was because that it was plagiarized. Beyond that, they don't seem to be taking responsibility for anything else. They've told me that they're going to reprint my response and also give Joshua Hammer the opportunity to respond to my response and put it on their website. I haven't seen it on their website yet, so I don't think it's there unless they've hidden it somewhere deep inside. But that was going to be their only kind of response to me, was to allow me to express myself on their website, and then allow Joshua Hammer to reply to all my, you know, allegations. Well, they seem to be kind of taking a step back and trying to make it seem like it's a matter between me and Joshua Hammer. Well, it isn't, because Mother Jones published it, but they don't seem to be... They haven't made a public apology about accidentally swiping Sandra Jordan's article. In fact, I believe Sandra Jordan only found out about it because Newsweek, Joshua Hammer's regular employer, contacted her to confirm whether or not she wrote these things and whether or not Joshua Hammer had consulted her before plagiarizing her. And so Mother Jones, you know, and I'm not trying to knock Mother Jones totally, but their attitude towards this article, the fact that they published it, and their response to it has been entirely irresponsible. It took them a long, long time for them to even get back to me. I left tons of messages with them. I even contacted them before I made my response public. But the fact that they just wouldn't respond to me forced me to make this public. and there has been a large response, but they seem to be kind of squirming around it by either not responding or claiming that, well, they get a lot of, in response to this article, they got a lot of compliments. They had people who actually thought it was a good article, and therefore that somehow offsets it. Or that they got a lot of complaints that it was too anti-Israel, as if somehow if you have someone complaining that it's too biased towards Israel and other people saying it's too biased against Israel, that somehow balances it out, which it isn't. You know, if you're a real journalist, you see, well, are the allegations valid? You know, is there an actual point behind it? And I believe that I made some clear points, and they refused to address it, rather trying to avoid it by saying, well, we got people complaining from both sides, and therefore somehow it's okay.
So essentially dismissing you, even though in your research you lay out the facts, and the fact is that this article that was depicted as investigative journalism was actually, as you say in your title, speculative journalism. It was formulated by web surfing right-wing websites, plagiarizing right-wing websites, plagiarizing articles, not citing where the information came from, and making a lot of speculations, as you point out in your article, speculative journalism, the making of the death of Rachel Corrie. And in fact, as it was not investigative journalism as it was presented as, and that is what Mother Jones is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a magazine that has solid articles based on fact that are, in fact, investigated by the authors, not plagiarized and not misleading or false. And it's not what I would expect from Mother Jones, and that's why I was so upset about it. Had I seen this in a right-wing publication, I can't say I would have pursued it. But it's being presented as some type of liberal analysis when, in fact, it is absolutely the opposite when it's taken apart, and you've done some amazing work researching it, and I appreciate that. So what do you recommend people do other than going to counterpunch.org or electronicintifada.net and reading your article, Speculative Journalism? What do you recommend they do?
Well, right now, Mother Jones has received hundreds and hundreds of complaints after my response was publicized in Counterpunch and Electronic Intifada. Mother Jones got a lot of complaints about the sloppy journalism in this article, but they haven't seemed to respond to it. They know they're getting tons, and I know they're getting tons, but they seem to be kind of trying to placate it by just publishing my response on their website, which I guess they will do eventually, and then also giving Joshua Hammer the chance to respond. That's a total cop-out. And so, you can, if you haven't complained to Mother Jones, go ahead and do so. Their email address is backtalk, B-A-C-K-T-A-L-K, at motherjones.com. Contact them and let them know that, you just find this very shameful of Mother Jones, and that we should expect better from magazines that claim to be progressive, and that, we should all be vigilant and look into, all these allegations and just kind of question what goes on with these articles. I mean, you expect this out of the Alan Dershowitz's book, which claims that Hamas funds ISM or something like that. That's typical. And the Wall Street Journal recently labeled the killings of the three Americans in Gaza as the Rachel Corrie Memorial Massacre. Well, you expect that from right-wing sources such as the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal or Alan Dershowitz. But you would expect more credibility, possibly, from progressive sources. So, if Joshua Hammer finds faults with ISM, then it's valid for him to write about those and make these connections. But he shouldn't be trying really hard to claim that ISM is reckless or too young and inexperienced based on his own inexperience with ISM.
I would like to thank you, Fawn, for joining me this afternoon and let you get on to your show, which is on at 4 o'clock on Chaos 89.3 FM in Olympia, Washington. Thanks so much for joining me today, Fawn.
Thanks for inviting me.
All right. Have a good show.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
And you're tuned to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. Again, I was speaking with Fawn Nguyen. He is the coordinator of the support group for the International Solidarity Movement in Olympia. He knew Rachel Corrie. He actually prepared her for her trip for her activism in Gaza. He lives in Olympia, Washington, as I mentioned, has a radio show there on Chaos Radio. It's called Bundle of Joy from 4 to 6 p.m. And you can read his article regarding the Joshua Hammer piece in Mother Jones at counterpunch.org or electronicintifada.net. The name of the article is Speculative Journalism, The Making of the Death of Rachel Corey. And before I end, I just wanted to comment that his article is really, really good, and I hope you'll read it. Some of the other quote-unquote facts that Joshua Hammer states in his article that Fawn blows away in his article, I'd just like to mention a couple more. The claim, there is a picture in the Mother Jones article of Rachel burning a paper American flag that was hand-drawn, and the caption to that picture makes the statement that it took place at a mock trial for George Bush, when in fact it actually occurred during worldwide protests against a pending U.S. war on Iraq on February 15th, in which Rachel Corey was one of over 10 million protesters. The mock trial happened a few weeks later, and he mentions there are several other minor errors such as this throughout the article. He mentions that he makes the claim that the ISM is, quote, a motley collection of anti-globalization and animal rights activists, self-described anarchists and seekers mostly in their 20s. The truth is actually that the ISM activists range in age from 18 to 77. The average age is somewhere in the middle years of 30s and 40s. They come from all backgrounds. I'm quoting now from Fawn Nguyen's article. From college students to soccer moms to white-collar professionals, and they have come from all over the world. Hammer merely demonstrates his limited experience and knowledge of the ISM by applying a cliche. Out of the hundreds of internationals who have participated in ISM campaigns, how many ISM activists has Hammer met personally? He also goes on to claim, to falsely claim, that the ISM, quote, embraces Palestinian militants, even suicide bombers, as freedom fighters, unquote, a baseless accusation commonly alleged and left unsubstantiated by right-wing pundits. As usual, he proclaims and elaborates no further. Perhaps next time he should provide us with the website link. And as if you were listening earlier, he plagiarized from a right-wing website, Front Page Magazine. He plagiarized things from that website and used them in his article. And this is just a couple more quotes briefly from Fawn Nguyen's piece. He says, what is amazing is that in Hammer's 7,000-word article, he spends very little time explaining what the ISM really is. He makes no mention of its purely nonviolent tactics or even its most basic activities, such as accompanying ambulances, assisting farmers in reaching their crops, clearing roadblocks, and walking children to school, perhaps because they're not sensationalist enough to merit his attention. He does not even explain ISM's goal, except for the misleading claim that ISM, quote, upholds the right to armed resistance. In truth, ISM's goal is to nonviolently resist the Israeli occupation. That simple objective is mentioned nowhere in his article. Instead, if we are to envision ISM, according to Hammer's description, we would have to imagine that it is a group of animal rights activists in their 20s who enter military zones and establish divestment campaigns. And that's a quote from Fawn Nguyen's article, Speculative Journalism, The Making of the Death of Rachel Corey. He claims in the article that they enter military zones, that this is one of the things that they do. Well, as Fawn Nguyen points out in his article, these quote-unquote military zones are often declared military zones after the ISM has gone to work there. He also points out that these quote-unquote military zones are actually civilian areas that are towns and villages and refugee camps inhabited by men, women, and children that are civilians and actually have invited the ISM members to be there in their homes with them to help protect them just by their mere presence, not through any kind of violent action. This is a totally nonviolent group. And to say that they are entering military zones is misleading when you take into account, as Fawn points out, that these military zones are actually civilian areas, that the Israeli army has declared military zones, but in fact are towns and villages. I just want to conclude by telling you again, you can go to counterpunch.org or electronicintifada.net to read Fawn Nguyen's article. It's called Speculative Journalism, The Making of the Death of Rachel Corrie, and it is about the article in the September-October 2003 Mother Jones issue called Death of an Activist, Was Rachel Corrie a Martyr or a Fool? By Joshua Hammer. Please write to Mother Jones, and please call Mother Jones to tell them why this article is disturbing to you. You can express your feelings towards Mother Jones and Hammer's shoddy reporting by sending letters to Backtalk, Mother Jones, 731 Market Street, Suite 600, San Francisco, California, 94103, or you can fax them at area code 415-665-6696, or you can email them at backtalk@motherjones.com. Again, send your letters to Backtalk, Mother Jones, 731 Market Street, Suite 600, San Francisco, California, 94103, or fax them at 415-665-6696, or simply email them at backtalk@motherjones.com. Please read the article. Again, you can read Fawn's article at counterpunch.org or electronicintifada.net. Those two websites, along with Fawn's article, have links to the original article by Joshua Hammer so that you can read it for yourself. And again, the ISM website is PALSolidarity.org. That's PALSolidarity.org, where you can read their lengthy mission statement and quite a lot of other information, including eyewitness accounts of Rachel Corrie's killing. And I believe there's also a website specifically for Rachel Corrie in memorial. It's rachelcorrie.org, and it's spelled RachelCorrie, rachelcorrie.org, to find out more as well.